question and answer period, I'm going to ask all three of the presenters to come up so that we don't have to run back and forth. And I'm going to ask you to state your name before you raise your question. Keep your questions brief, and the respondents will hopefully keep their responses brief. And so let's have at it. You could direct your question to an individual, or they will choose who will answer. Bob?
My name is Bob Anderson. Listen, I've got a whole lot of things I'd like to say, and of course I can't do that here. But one thing that's sort of general, as I listened to the Vice President speak, I heard him talking about growth, as though growth and growth and growth is a good thing, no suggestion of a limit to it, or no suggestion size makes any difference. I heard him talk about privatization of the university, that is, seeking partners with corporate world. He talked about having learned from corporations, how the university having learned so that it can function similarly. I guess my question has to do with an observation that the university itself is now functioning as a corporation, and with a CEO at the top and officers on down. It's really functioning as a corporation in itself. And I'm concerned about that, quite in addition to the relationship of corporations to the university and so on. We all know that the Board of Governors is almost completely government political appointments. So there's the government and the university becoming a corporation, on which I'd like comment.
Thanks very much, Bob. Is the University of Lethbridge acting like a corporation? Post-Secondary Learning Act defines our rules. And yes, it sets us up. It talks about chief executive officers. It talks about operating officers and the responsibilities of the positions in the administration. In many ways, a lot of the language one would see in corporations is in the Post-Secondary Learning Act. In that way, the way the university functions, it is unavoidable that we have similarities to corporations and, quite honestly, in this community, large corporations. What's very important to recognize as you go through that is that the people who end up in administration, commonly known in my community as having gone to the dark side, are and never lose their rights as academics. We take those forward, and it's not the easiest of transitions for anyone who's been in those steps. I'll point that out. But at the heart of what it's all about, our universities, corporations, recognize it's academics who are the administrators. And we still have all the values. We're steeped in the tradition of the academy. And we never lose the strength of those values. If we can't have the open debate, if we can't have the criticisms that are not allowed in corporations or are shunned, then we've lost what we're about. Quite honestly, the way we do business, the way all post-secondary institutions do business, we are like corporations. What we try and do, however, is take the best moral compass in what we're doing and put our best foot forward with it. Yes, there are mistakes made, but the days of groups of happy scholars getting together and, you know, not running a business model are gone. We are held accountable for the way we do business by this government. And that level of accountability is then passed on to the taxpayers. And I have to respect that. I understand the limits of it, but I do have to respect that guidance that the Post-Secondary Learning Act gives me in the way I have to conduct business. So it's not a direct answer to your question, I appreciate that, but I would say that the way things are set up, there are very few options for us.
I'm Trevor Page. Gentlemen, thank you for your presentations. My question is a specific question, and it deals specifically with the U of L. and it's directed to Andrew Aiken. And I'd like to know currently what is the proportion of corporate research grants to the university in the overall, as a percentage of the overall level of grants, and whether the percentage of corporate funding is increasing or decreasing. And thirdly, whether you actually internally have a cap on it, or is it just if a corporation wants to fund something, it can. So the relative level at this time, the trend, and whether you internally have a cap on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Trevor. A very good question. In order to answer it, I have to really go back and identify what has been the key source of funding within any institution for many, many years. And it's referred to as tri-council funding. Whereas the provincial government pay for the running of the institution, it's a provincial requirement. The federal government, for the most part, provided many of the research funds. And the tri-councils are Natural Science and Engineering Research Council, Social Sciences Humanities Research Council, and the health-related body, CIHR. For many, many years, 80% plus of the funding that came into the University of Lethbridge was from federal granting agencies. In the last 10 years, you've seen a change. Why is that? It's because the amount of money coming out of the federal government for research has decreased. The number of researchers to do research in the academy has increased. The public purse, taxpayers' money, can't be stretched that thin. Otherwise, what you do is enough, you give people enough money to do nothing. By necessity, you have to make sure that academics have money to do research. And I will say that the university, for the most part, is not the one that goes out and finds that. We respect the way individuals run with their research. We don't get into directing individuals what they do in the academy. And so yes, there's corporate funding, and it's filled a lot of the void. I don't have specific numbers. I don't have those. I would say we've gone from 80 down to about 60% in federal funding.
So proportion of corporate versus...
I don't have a number for corporate funding directly, Trevor.
And how can you have a policy?
There is no policy. There is no policy that dictates for the academy where research funding will come from, other than if it's not from the federal requirements, the faculty members, for the most part, drive it. It is not that administration make decisions on these things. It is driven by the faculty to go in directions that support their research. And that, in many sectors, would be a statement that would not be understood at all. But within the academy, it's perfectly understood.
Is the proportion of corporate going up or down?
I would suspect that the proportion is going up.
Okay, I think we need another question. Thank you. My name is Van Christu. I'd like to express my personal thanks, and I'm sure on behalf of everyone here, for the three of you coming out today to give us this wonderful presentation. I think that a number of things that came up in all three of these presentations was the importance of the autonomy of academia, the importance of the autonomy of universities in our society in terms of the very basis of our democratic principles. It's one of the only places in our society where democracy can really function completely and becomes an example to the rest of our society. If I may for a minute inject a personal view on this, I was fortunate enough to be on the founding board of governors at the University of Lethbridge back in 1967, when we got our charter. And I was really pleased at that time that the premier who is Ernest Manning, had the wisdom to appoint people to that founding board who represented all stripes of political thinking. I certainly wasn't a social creditor at that time and was appointed to that board. And we had NDP people on that board. We had an entire spectrum. Since Peter Lougheed's time, we have not had nothing but card-carrying conservatives appointed to the boards in the province. I don't think the public is aware of how dangerous that is and how much we've lost. I would say that one of the great strengths of the University of Lethbridge and the way it's developed so well over these years, to where we have almost 8,500 students today, began with that good founding board of governors and the attitudes that they established for that university. We're losing that, where we have only one political stripe making the decisions of who they hire for president and so on and so forth. Now, it's still a democratic institution, and we still have a GFC, and we have the faculty and so on all involved. But when you have a board that's committed in only one direction politically, you're in trouble. My question is, do you people see that as being something that we can address and get across to the public so we get a little more pressure and a little more fairness politically?
Maybe I won't give a full answer, but I'll start off by giving a bit more meat on the bones that's been put out there. University operation is a bicameral system. So you have a board that looks to the governance of the institution. And then you have a general faculty's council that looks to the policies and procedures and the business of the academics. When you have a board that gets into dictating what the academic side of the house should be doing in terms of policies and procedures, you've got an issue. But luckily, what we have at the moment is a system whereby they balance each other, and that was the intention. But there's always a danger with political appointments that it could always sway in a different direction. But for the most part, the bicameral system is designed to keep things in balance. Now, I'll let my colleagues, I've spoken too much at the mic, I'll let my colleagues talk more about it.
I want to talk about climate change, but I guess I'm not going to go with that right now.
What do you think of the climate?
Yeah. It is definitely, I agree with you, John, and it's a hot climate too as well. I appreciate Andy's comments about the bicameral system. I do think that the board is definitely likes to push a lot of things at University of Lethbridge, and I think, quite frankly, the message I would have is for my colleagues, wake up. And the message applies within University of Lethbridge and applies beyond. We have tenure for a reason. We have tenure because we're supposed to speak out on community issues, on national issues, on global issues. And quite frankly, I wrote an article a few years ago where I spoke about silent liars, and many people have said the worst liar you can deal with is a liar who knows better and doesn't speak. Martin Luther King said, in the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. And I can't point at any one of my colleagues and say, you're not speaking out, but I can point at them as a community and I say, we have lost our way to some degree as academics. We do not speak out on issues anymore as academics, and we're not leading society. And I don't know if it's because we're tied in with a corporate agenda or we're too concerned with that corporate research grant. There's one hell of a lot of that. But we have lost track, and virtually none of my colleagues speak out. I better be careful with that virtually, because you do get it. But my colleagues do not speak out. And I'm speaking about the academic community in Canada, very, very few. And it's a shame, and I think that we're really missing out on a substantial part of our role in society. And, that's what we have tenure for, to speak out about so many of these things within campus and all over society. So I'll leave it with that.
And
Andy talked about what we'd learned from corporations, and of course he gave you the structure, you know, the GFC and the board. The structure's still there, but I think certainly over the years I've been there, is the culture is really changing, and it's really important. And it's a very corporate culture that I'm seeing. I mean, the obvious ones are user pay. You know, that's a corporate sort of notion, okay? So public education, but you pay, you know. Casual labor. We have huge volumes of casual labor there. We call them sessionals. And there are too many of them. And they don't really have academic freedom in that sort of sense. But they are cheap labor. And that is a corporate thing. I mean, that's the way corporations work. So I think that's my sort of sense of, and it relates a little bit to perhaps Van's notion, but it's perhaps not the structure. I'm glad the structure's there, but the culture. The other thing, and again, I don't want to get really into too much detail on this, but we've had up at the university quite a number of gross professional misconduct charges. And that does not fit in very well to the collegial process, to the academic freedom sort of issues. And again, I'm just seeing signs of, you know, that contract, if you like, you know, beginning to unwind with regard to what's appropriate to say as an academic, perhaps being critical of an administrator who now, believe it or not, is a CEO. I mean, that's what the Act will say with these things. So the language is also there. So I think that is it. It's the culture that concerns me. The structures are still there, but without the culture, I don't think they're going to continue to work.
Mark Sandilands, make a comment and then ask a question about the Board of Governors being appointed. I would like to see a world in which the alumni of the university elect the Board of Governors. They are the ones who speak for the individuals who've come through the system, who understand to some extent or another the idea of an academic life. That is definitely not happening, and as Van pointed out, since Peter Lougheed became Premier, the Board of Governors has been very much a wing of the Conservative Party. Andy spoke of the bicameral system, the General Faculty's Council. My understanding is that General Faculty's Council has become a paper tiger. The members of the General Faculty Council have to be majority elected from the academy, but actually a very large number of the members of the General Faculty Council are appointed, and they're appointed from administration. So that the General Faculty's Council, which used to be a hotbed of lively debate, the days of the now deceased Bill Lambert and Paul Upton having a huge fight over whether the hockey program would be funded or not. There were marvelous debates in General Faculty's Council. As I understand it now, it's a yes, sir, and things happen. So I don't think the bicameral system is working, and that's a serious problem. And with the large number of as Ian pointed out, casual workers, they're not foreign, but I mean, some of them are, but they are temporary workers. They don't have tenure. They can't speak out. And even the members of the faculty who are working to get tenure, because you don't get it automatically, who are working to get promoted, you don't get that automatically. They have to get research grants, and you can't speak out if you're going to get corporate funding for your research. So that's a serious problem. And the root of it is the corporations. So my question is, there are places, interestingly, in the New England states of the United States where cities and towns are passing rules taking away the rights of personhood from corporations. And I'm going to ask Ian, as the legal scholar, is that a possibility? Does that movement, which is growing, is that a possibility to spread? Is there a possibility for these kinds of things to happen in Canada, perhaps right even here in Lethbridge?
presumably, if the government's decided to get rid of the legislation that creates corporations, either provincial or federal, they're both, they'll have got rid of the legislation. Now, the tricky thing is the Charter of Rights and Freedoms actually indicates that corporations are persons, that we have given them the rights of personhood, and I think that an attempt to do that here in Canada would actually, well, of course, it would be challenged, obviously, by the corporate lawyers, and probably upheld by the corporate lawyer, former corporate lawyer, who's sitting on the bench. Because remember, that is the reality now. I mean, with regard to law and getting law, it's going to be, it's corporate law now, and most of the judges have gone through the ranks, and they see the world as corporations. So I think it would be quite difficult. I'm not familiar enough with the United States. they do have certain constitutional rights, of course, in the United States. They weren't intended to. Remember that the right to own property was for blacks. You know, the 14th Amendment was passed with regard to protecting the property of blacks, but virtually every case that has ever been dealt with under there was corporations saying, hey, we're persons too, and so we can own property and so on. So I would say that I'm pleased to hear that, but I'm not sure if it would be so easy in Canada as it perhaps is there.
Good afternoon. My name is Stan. Fortunately or unfortunately, I'm also a student. And one of the things that was quite interesting is back in October, the students had a meeting up at the university, and one of the questions they wanted to look at was, you know, how liberal is our education? And, you know, if you put it on a scale between a liberal education and a corporate agenda, you know, at the end of the discussion, the consensus, what is it, was very much corporate. But one of the things that wanted to ask was, is there a way that we can monitor and do some research to find out exactly where it is, so that we can start the discussion at some point between the academics and the students.
Jeez, and I want to go back to climate change again. that's. I think that's something we should always have going, Stan. And actually, I think perhaps there's a bit of a cool atmosphere that infects students now, because I've known students who feel that, you know, they're concerned about their programs and concerned about speaking out. It's something that maybe, you know, students just have to become more active and you know, get in the dialogue. In my view, you know, since we're on this sort of, you know, corporate plan that says we're providing a service to the students, I think they should be damn noisy about the things that they should be getting and believing, you know, and asking for. I'm astonished at the complacency of students actually nowadays. And I'm even going to fess right up to this to Andy. I mean, I talk to my students in my second year class and say, you guys are remarkably complacent, and you should be demanding more, and you should be realizing you're paying a hell of a lot more for your education than I paid for mine, and that they, you know, students really should be in being very active and very pushy in terms of the value they're getting. They're paying a huge amount of money. And remember that the people that have inflicted these costs on them are their parents, who paid practically nothing for their education. My cost for education was just about nothing in comparison, and I think it's terrible the costs we're inflicting on students for the education. So they're paying, they should be talking, and I would encourage them. The reason for the fear, I'm not sure. You know, there's just no way for an administrator, no matter how noisy a student is. I mean, he can't affect a student. You know, I mean, it's an independent system. The faculty grade the students. Make noise. That's all I can say, you know, to the students.
If I could just add one small part of that. Curriculum is the bread and butter of a university. it's, as I said when I gave my talk for 10 minutes there, it's kind of at the soul of what we do. But it's important to realize where that curriculum comes from, because I think it's important to recognize in the context of the discussion we're having. That isn't from administration. The administration don't decide we shall do X, Y, and Z. Programs come from faculty and move up. And if we're doing our job, we're assessing the needs of our students as we go, and we're trying to incorporate what we see in our research and what the latest ideas and what the latest approaches are back into curriculum. And then it goes up and it's approved by the grander bodies, et cetera, et cetera. But your point is a good one. What you're saying to me is that the students are not having the input in directing program needs and requirements. And I think that Jim has made a very good point there. You have to say what's important to you as students. Those areas for debate and discussion of what curriculum about are certainly present in universities. And all I would do as an administrator is to encourage you to use the vehicles that are available to you. There are vehicles for input. There's student representation on all the committees that go through things. But start talking about it. If this is a priority of students at the U of L, then that should be something that comes through the Students' Union. The Academy is a place where debate takes place. And we might have sides about what side of the view we're on, but at the end of the day, we're in it for one purpose, and that is to move things forward. So if there's a way to go, bring it forward.
Can I just add one thing, Bob, to that?
No.
Stan, just to follow up, you've given me an idea because I've had something, and it's maybe it's still to be born, just continuing to evolve in my mind, but I think I'm going to move towards suggesting a course on activism, and maybe we should get some of this back going because it's something that we really need students and everybody to do.
Jim, I want to congratulate you on getting the Water Research Institute in only 20 years. Now, when I came to Lethbridge, I came from a land-grant college, and they were accepting money. And when I came to Lethbridge, I had a proposal. I went to my boss and said, you know, we ought to do some work on this. I think we can get some money from Canada Packers or someplace, you know. And he says, if it's worth doing, we will fund it. Well, the last 2 years I worked, I was told that if I wanted to do any research and I wanted 80 head of steers, that I had to supply the steers, and I had to supply some portion, but they didn't tell me what portion, of the feed. And I said, how do I do that? And they said, that's for you to figure out. Well, I happened to bump into a friend who had a feedlot, and I said, you're feeding cattle. How would you like to lend me 80 steers and buy some of the feed? And he says, sure, I'll do that. I don't care whether the cattle are in your feedlot or my feedlot. But the reason he did it was that I had built a reputation with him, a rapport, you know, and so on. And I built a certain amount of credibility. Now, it took me 28 years, and you did it in 20 years. So you did a wonderful job.
We need to get to the question, Bob.
When you're looking at funding, how much do the providers of the funds look at the reputation or the, you know, the background of the scientists before they decide whether they're going to give the money?
Sure, I'll jump all over that one. Bob, I think that's definitely part of it. They, you know, in many cases, and you know what the answer is, they do everything. You know, at the worst case, you know, if it's a think tank, it's more what you're going to say. You know, if they're trying to get the right answer and you're going to say it, probably your reputation as a scientist isn't as important. A scientist and an academic with a good reputation will be careful to make sure that they're doing the right thing and they're not being compromised. So, you know, dealing with those funders, I think definitely the harder you work, the more you've published in many cases, if they realize that's the currency. You know, and many funders maybe don't always realize that. An educated funder does realize that the currency is your publication record and your word.
And that's probably what we have to continue to protect in terms of academics. So, you know, that wasn't a direct answer to your question, but it's the best I can. And I don't know, 28 years and you did it, I think that's great. And 20 years, I think the last 10 I had a lot of help. So, and it was still a damn uphill battle and trouble. So anyway, I'll turn it over to any of my colleagues if they want to.
We're getting close to the end, so I'm afraid there will only be time for two more questions. Howard, we're going to give you the last one.
Well, I want to thank all three of the speakers for giving us a very enlightened discussion today. I guess what I'm seeing is corporate greed, and witness today's Lethbridge Herald, in which, Jim, you would be happy or sad to see that 900 scientists who were working in the environmental movement were at one time or another during their career told that they had to change their results before they could publish it or change their publications. So I see this corporate creep coming everywhere. And I guess as much as I enjoyed Andrew's presentation, I'm concerned with your goal of growing the university to sustainability. Again, we're back to corporate language. I would have to say to grow it, we'd have to have more students and more students who end up paying for their entire lifetime, paying back their fees. So maybe to turn this whole thing around, we could really push for having free tuition for students as we do in many of the European countries. Over to Andrew.
I couldn't applaud that statement more. As a person whose whole education, undergraduate and then postgraduate education, was paid for by a government, I fully understand what that did for me. I would urge you all to get out there and make that case. It took many years for this government to realize, with the revenues that they have, that they could do away with healthcare premiums. Education and paying for education and the cost it is now, I would say that's another central issue. You got to lobby, and you got to lobby hard. Yes, there are people who will not come to the academy because of cost. I would have been one of those kids. There's no doubt about it. And I'll comment on the comments of growth. University of Lethbridge has grown because of the demand, and it was student demand. And it's addressing that need is how we've gone forward. Will that need be there in the future? Will the students be there? If I'm to look at the demographics, and I look at it very hard every week to see what's changing and where students are coming from, I would say to you that the University of Lethbridge is not going to be much bigger than it is now. So therefore, the question becomes, how do we make that experience even better? And by growth, that's how I would categorize my mission, is to make the experience better and better for the students who come to us. So this is undoubtedly the best experience of all experiences they could have in post-secondary.
My name is Jack Drake. Now, I'm been a lecturer here in Lethbridge while the university was being built. I helped build it. But I have a question here. I've asked it before, and I think I should direct it to Dr. Byrne. And what I want to know is, what is the amount of oxygen in this room measured in percent of any cubic mass of air? Question one. And question two is, what was the percent of oxygen in 1900? And at 70 million years ago? So you have three answers, please. And thank you. And if you don't want to do it right now, write them down and send them to me.
Oh, yeah. I, Gee, sir, I don't think I want to talk about climate change.
No, you've been sure.
Yeah.
So have I.
Yes, you have been. I don't think, you know, in terms of giving you explicit answers, I would actually turn that over to Andy Vasgona, because he's a wonderful chemist and can probably do those things. And I don't deal in atmospheric chemistry, but what I detect, perhaps, is a slight doubt in the climate change phenomena, perhaps. I would want to respond to that and say that I'm not sure that the question would warrant an answer that addresses the issue. So I do appreciate your question. I possibly don't understand exactly where you want to go with it either. So I think what we should do is you and I should sit down for a bit when we get a chance and talk about it. And you bet. I would once I know where you're going, I'd love to give you my very best science answer, and we'll put it in the paper, or we'll put it, you know, or we'll get Shaw back here in a couple of weeks to get it, you know, on the public record without a doubt. But we'll have to do it in June, because on Saturday morning I'm out of here for a month. We can't. Well, I'll turn you over to Andy and see if he's got a better answer, or maybe we'll chat for a few minutes afterwards.
You never know when your science background is going to come into need here. And there's a sort of lecturer in the area of chemistry for many years. I've got some ballpark figures for what gases in the environment are. Roughly, the type of model, the general model that one puts out is that you've got about 16% oxygen, somewhere in that region.
Be careful what you're saying.
Dependent, and I say that because I'm dealing in a closed room of many people putting out CO2. The generalizations, as Jim says, in the atmosphere, the breathable part of the atmosphere, about 20-odd%. What we do know, and has been measured, is the general increase in greenhouse gases over many years. And there are many studies done since the term. One figure comes to my mind, and that's the CO2 in the atmosphere above Hawaii from the period of about 1930 to about 1990. And what you saw was a general increase in carbon dioxide. And it's obviously got seasonal variation. So it's a general increase with a seasonal variation dependent on the plant growth on the island. Is there any doubt that carbon dioxide was increasing? No. I think that's a statement all can agree on. Is there any question about the amount of ozone that's in the atmosphere compared to what it used to be? No. That's not in question anymore either. And the impact that that's having on the ability of UV rays to come through the atmosphere, that's not in question. Where will we end up? Do we understand the bulk model of climate change for the planet? We're making good headway. A lot of the results are out there, and a lot of people don't want to hear them. But I don't think there's one model. But I'll turn to my colleague here to say that there's one model on climate change that everyone agrees to. So it is one of the more difficult areas of science at the moment. There's a lot, especially in our province, of corporations that would like nothing more than not to talk about the environment. And, you know, tying it back to what we've talked about all day, it's essential that people do talk about the environment. It's our legacy. It's our legacy to the future generations. And that's a bit cliched even to say it now, but I don't really think it is. The tough debates, the tough questions about what those oil sands are doing up north, and the ponds that they leave behind full of many toxins and contaminants have to be addressed. It's an eyesore. It's a planet sore, and we need to get on with it. The economy can produce areas of research that'll help, but we have to be willing to ask the goddamn question first, and I apologize for my language here, but that's the way I feel about it. We have to be willing to ask the question of what we're doing. And there are many people who are not there yet.
In this room, what do you feel is the percent
In this room, I have no idea. It probably decreases with closed doors and closed circulation, like any building. With people breathing in oxygen, putting out CO2, your percentage probably goes down, and there are probably legislated requirements for oxygen content in any building. But for the most part, people are not monitoring them.
I think we've had a really good demonstration of how you get three brilliant academics together. You can go anywhere and get a great discussion going. So I want to thank the speakers very much. And I would like to remind you about next week's topic. It's called Has Exhibition Park Outgrown Its Present Location? And the speakers will be Georgina Kneedle, President, and Rudy Friesen, General Manager of Exhibition Park. So please, I hope to see you all next week. Thank you for coming.
I have to run to get some work done, but James and I don't know, are you a surfer on the Euro board?
Yeah.